Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 25th, 1998, and in the Fireside Building this morning we have Joan Back. Her session number is 98-2. It's entitled Elijah's Way, 1 Kings 18. Which God rules? Let's listen in.
Ahab, the northern kingdom and its capital Samaria collapsed, were overtaken by the Assyrian Empire, and existed no more. Meanwhile, in the south, their first king Rehoboam, who was the son of Solomon, so the dynasty of David continued here for the most part, lasted longer than the northern kingdom. In fact, 135 years longer than the northern kingdom, but finally was destroyed by the Babylonians. Thanks a lot. Was destroyed by the Babylonians, and the people were taken into exile. Where this history was written was after the fall of Samaria in the northern kingdom, about halfway towards the fall of Jerusalem. So in a very troubled period, right in here, where they were going, yikes, our compatriots to the north have just been destroyed and gone. What can we do to avoid the same fate? How can we continue to exist and survive? And there was a reform-minded king named Josiah who rediscovered the covenant and the law and thought, and with his prophets and advisors, thought, this is the way to go, this is the way to safety, this is the way to be a light to the world, to follow the covenant that God has given us. And so some historians, some preacher historians in Josiah's court, look back at all these old stories that they had from their own geography in the south and that they had from the north, which no longer existed, but some exiles had, some refugees had come down to live with them. And they put it all in a continuous story told in a way that tries to make the morals really clear. The moral of the story is, we have a precious heritage with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob, whose name became Israel, who freed our people when we were slaves in Egypt, who gave us a covenant. And if we live by that covenant, we will be who we need to be, and God will keep us safe. So at Josiah's time, they're telling the story of King Ahab and how Elijah spoke to Ahab and said, remember the covenant, in order that the people at Josiah's time can make the right choice and renew their living in the covenant. But didn't work from the point of view of saving their national necks, because they did fall to the Babylonian Empire. They got taken into exile. And in the exile, the whole history was updated more. They had all of this to this point, and then the Deuteronomic historian continued to write what happens from Josiah on down through the exile. Now it's from a little different point of view. It's no longer, if we reform, we'll be safe. Now it's from the point of view of, we're in a culture that's not friendly to us, this Babylonian culture. Are we going to assimilate, or are we going to remain people of God with an identity in the covenant? And how do we make the choices that will preserve who we are as God's people and as God's light to the world? And so those stories of Ahab and Elijah calling the people to worship God, not Baal, become an inspiration to the people living in the exile. And I think it's real interesting to think about our own situation and say, is our time more like King Josiah's time, where we want to, where we feel like we have power and we want to institute reforms? Or is our time more like the time of exile, when our power at large is minimal, but we have the opportunity to maintain an identity and be a witness? You want to just respond to that off the top of your head a little bit? Mm-hmm. Maybe we can go ahead.
I don't think people generally respond when they're in power to reform their lives. Generally, they reform their lives when desperate straits, mm-hmm. as individuals. I would imagine that collectively it would be more difficult.
Yeah.
But when you have a visionary like Josiah, you could get it started, but you can't, you have to maintain it with, you know, future great leaders.
You bet. And you see the principle at work too. Josiah and his historians looking back at the time of Ahab, seeing how the choices were laid out then, therefore these are the choices laid out for us now, would be like us looking back to Abraham Lincoln, for instance, or George Washington and saying, remember how we were founded, therefore this is what we're doing now. Same principle at work in these chapters. Remember how Elijah confronted the prophets of Baal and how God confronted Baal, and Elijah and God won. Therefore, it's clear, isn't it, people, what our choices now are and ought to be? It's a way of opening up our decisions about our own lives and society. Let's pray. We bless you, God, maker of the universe and of everything that is, for you've called us to be your people, gathered us here today, mean to inspire us by the stories of your people who've gone before us. We ask that your Spirit will lead us in our listening to this story and our discerning of our own situation so that we may say yes to you and no to everything that would stand in the way of your gracious kingdom coming through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Please turn with me to Psalm 145. Oh, 45. Psalm 45. This is a love song and a wedding psalm. The poet, the singer, the minstrel says, my heart overflows with a goodly theme. I address my verses to the king. My tongue is like the pen of a ready scribe. So here comes, first of all, the hymn to the king, who is also the groom. You are the most handsome of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. Gird your sword on your thigh, O mighty one, in your glory and majesty. In your majesty, ride on victoriously. For the cause of truth and to defend the right, let your right hand teach you dread deeds. Your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies. The people fall under you. Your throne, O God, endures forever and ever. Your royal scepter is a scepter of equity. You love righteousness and hate wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, this is talking to the king again, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. Your robes are all fragrant with myrrh and aloes and cassia. From ivory palaces, stringed instruments make you glad. Daughters of kings are among your ladies of honor. At your right hand stands the queen in gold of Ophir. The ivory palace was the palace in Samaria of the northern kingdom. Archaeology has shown us. The king being addressed here is probably Ahab on his wedding day or standing with his bride Jezebel, the queen in gold. The next stanzas describe the queen. Hear, O daughter, consider and incline your ear. Forget your people and your father's house. The king will desire your beauty since he is your lord. Bow to him. The people of Tyre, those are your people, will now come here to seek your favor with gifts, the richest of the people with all kinds of wealth. We know that Jezebel came from Tyre, where her father was the king and the head priest. And then it goes on to describe the princess's beauty and her gold robes, many colored robes, led to the kings with joy and gladness, and so, and a big celebration forever and ever. This is definitely a psalm of blessing and magnanimity, and it shows us that at some point in their history, the people of Israel welcomed the marriage of Ahab and Jezebel and thought it was really a good thing. When did it go sour? When did it go bad? Ahab was probably trying to be a really smart statesman in making an alliance with the daughter of the king of Tyre, though she worshipped a different god than the Israelites did, it was politically smart because it was a way of rapprochement. It was a way of saying, you know, we can all live together. I can recognize your customs. You can recognize our customs. We can be a peaceable country. There was, however, a nucleus within Israel that said, we're losing too much if we start bringing in practices from the outside. There's more at stake here than political peaceableness. What's at stake here is losing our identity as people of God's covenant and as God's light to the world. And the way they understood this, according to Paul Hansen, who's a Bible teacher who's often been at Holden, you can go listen to his tapes, is that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, who freed the people from slavery in Egypt, brought them into the wilderness, gave them the gift of the law, or the covenant. Well, the covenant consisted of two important parts. The one part was righteousness, fair, orderly, decent treatment of one another, careful treatment of one another. Think of the Ten Commandments. We honor God, we honor and care for the relationships with one another by honoring our parents, by honoring marriage, by not stealing, by not bearing false witness against one another, by not desiring one another's property or relationships, and by, which one did I leave out? By not killing, yeah, doing bodily harm. Righteousness is important. There's also a strong element of, remember, you were slaves and God freed the slaves. Compassion is an integral part of this covenant. You reach out, especially those who are marginalized, have no voice, have no power. Feed the hungry, take care of the widows and the orphans. Let the strangers among you have a place in the society and not be marginalized. Even give your animals a rest on the Sabbath. And righteousness and compassion are the shape of this covenant. What holds it together, what supports these two practices, is worship of not just any old worship, but the worship of the God who has these ethics and these values, namely the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the one who brought us out of slavery in Egypt. And so we worship this one God because this God is, and because this God acts on our behalf, and because that's what keeps us practicing these values of righteousness and compassion. And so the problem is, if we worship somebody else who has another God who has other values, these things collapse and fall apart. That's why worship of God is so important. It's because of the whole structure of the covenant that goes with it. And so what Elijah is saying, what the prophets, it seems like the Elijah stories, and in these chapters there are stories of other prophets. There's Micaiah and there's Abijah and there's a couple other prophets. It seems like it was the prophetic community in Israel who kept these stories alive and who also were the nucleus of this protest against the kings turning their allegiance to any god but God. And they weren't just jealous for God's name, they were jealous for this whole ball of wax, because you remove the worship of God and who knows what these other gods will lead you into doing or lead you into failing to do. And so today Elijah shows up in public to challenge any other god, namely Baal in this case, to a contest to say, who is the true God? Because if we worship the God of Israel, then the whole society will be rightly ordered and compassion will be its nature and its theme. We especially see that in 2 days when we look at chapter 21, Naboth's vineyard. It really highlights the values of the covenant with Yahweh for compassion and for righteousness. But today we're looking especially at that bottom support, the worship. Who are we going to follow? So, 1 Kings 18.
Thank you.
we go back to the beginning of chapter 17, I just want you to look at one thing about how God is named by Elijah. Elijah says this, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word." Elijah proclaims God, the God of Israel, as the one who lives. Now let that, hold that in your mind as we read through chapter 18 and see how many times it comes up. And also realize the implication is, if the God of Israel lives, then what about the other God who's competing with the God of Israel? The other God doesn't live, at least doesn't act. So, chapter 18 contains the really famous story, and this was the one that was hands down my favorite when I was a kid in Sunday school, the story of the single prophet Elijah standing up against 850 of the prophets who represent Baal and the goddess Asherah. And God is the one who acts, and Baal fails to act. And it's perfectly clear which God is alive, and the people realize it too, and they say, yes, 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 we will follow the God of Israel. It turns out that life isn't that simple. I think I like this story because it was so clear and so easy, and we live in a lot murkier of a world. And you know, I think the story was written and told at times that were a lot murkier. What are we going to do? They were trying to decide in Josiah's time, and how can we be a people in this beleaguered circumstance? They were trying to discover during the exile. So looking back, it seems more clearly drawn, and that's in order to inspire us now. That famous story is the center of chapter 18, but there's some other interesting stuff in here that I wasn't familiar with until I started studying for this week. So we need to look at the beginning of chapter 18. Elijah reappears in public and comes to face the king. He's been in hiding since making this prophecy that the Lord told him to make. And now he shows up. Verse 1 of chapter 18. After many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year of the drought, saying, "Go present yourself to Ahab. I will send rain on the earth." God's mind has changed, or God's timing has arrived, that God is going to reverse the drought. Nobody else knows it except God and Elijah at this point. But Elijah, knowing what direction God is heading, moves in freedom now to come back to the places that he's been hiding from and banished from. And I appreciate it if somebody would read verses 2 to 16.
So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria, and Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now Obadiah revered the Lord greatly, and when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by fifties in a cave and fed them with bread and water. And Ahab said to Obadiah, "Go through the land to all the springs of water and to all the valleys. Perhaps we may find grass and save the horses and mules alive and not lose some of the animals." So they divided the land between them to pass through it. Ahab went in one direction by himself, and Obadiah went in another direction by himself. And as Obadiah was on the way, behold, Elijah met him. And Obadiah recognized him and fell on his face and said, "Is it you, my lord Elijah?" And he answered him, "It is I. Go tell your lord, behold, Elijah is here." And he said, "Wherein have I sinned that you would give your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom whether my lord has not sent you to me to seek you." And when they would say, "He is not here," he would take an oath of the kingdom or nation that they had not found you. And now you say, "Go tell your lord, behold, Elijah is here. And as soon as I have gone from you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you whether I know not. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he cannot find you, he will kill me, although I, your servant, have revered the Lord from my youth." Has it not been told my Lord what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water? And now you say, go, tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here, and he will kill me. And Elijah said, as the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah.
Well, it sort of seems like the story's not getting nowhere fast in these 16 verses, but I think this functions in the story to ratchet up the tension a little bit and to make some of the pain of the situation a little bit clearer. What do you see is advanced by these 16 verses, or how's the tension increased? What's gained by putting this encounter in here?
Well, it sort of points out the hatred or the fear that Ahab has for Elijah.
You betcha.
I mean, it's so extreme that he's searched all over the world for him, and that he would kill anybody that told him he was there and then not there.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so he had a lot of power over Ahab that Ahab didn't like.
That's right. That's right. And Ahab is moving in fear, and Elijah is moving in confidence. At this point, I mean, he was in some fear in the previous chapter when he went to hide from Ahab. But now, knowing what direction the Lord is moving, he is able to move in confidence and show up in front of Ahab.
Why would Ahab be afraid of Elijah?
Well, he thinks that if he can control Elijah, he can control God. Because Elijah is representing this threat of God not to send rain. So, you know, if only he could get Elijah under control, then presumably he could get the rain back. Huh. I think we find out in these 16 verses how bad the drought is, so that we're more there emotionally with them. The drought is so bad that even the king is not, I mean, who's the last person who's going to be touched by the effects of a drought? The king. And the king himself, as well as his chief steward, have to head out on foot with the horses and mules, looking for any little green bits of grass by any little trickles of water that might still be running down the wadis, or the places that run water when it rains.
Might it be true, too, that when people are in these dire straits, that his backers might be rebelling, too? So that could be another source of fear.
Yeah. Another thing that we learn from these verses is that it's not all gone over to Baal. And right even there in Ahab's own house, his chief steward is someone who still values the covenant and the prophets who would support the covenant. And at his own expense, presumably, he's been hiding some prophets to keep them alive while Jezebel has been killing them off or massacring them. And it kind of also shows how badly Ahab has forsaken the covenant, because as king representing Yahweh to the people and representing the people to Yahweh, his first responsibility is to his people, and here he is spending his time with his horses and mules instead of caring for the hungry who might be in his kingdom.
And you also wonder about Obadiah, and I mean, basically, he was in exile because he's in this household that, you know, is not revering God, and he still is.
Yeah.
And all the other prophets, I mean, he wasn't a prophet, but, you know, basically, most of his support must have been taken away, and yet he has maintained his faith.
Yeah. It's been pointed out that Ahab's two sons had names that reflected the covenant, Jehoram and Abijah. Both of them have the J-E or the J-A-H that signals Yahweh as part of their names. So the assumption is that Ahab didn't see that he was doing anything wrong. Ahab apparently considered himself to be faithful to Yahweh, but he thought it was possible to be faithful to Yahweh and to allow worship of Baal. So he let Jezebel have her way, and in fact encouraged and supported her worship of Baal by himself worshiping Baal. So it's real interesting to see that he thought he could have his cake and eat it too. And part of the prophetic critique in this story is that not choosing God only is not choosing, or it's actually choosing against God. If you think you're choosing God and something else, you are not in fact choosing God, because to choose God means to choose only God. Yeah.
This is not the same Obadiah whose book appears later.
Some people think it is, possibly not, probably not. And I didn't go down that track to really review Obadiah and what time period it reflects, but I do understand that something Obadiah says here is like a quote of the first verse of Obadiah. So people were presuming that they were the same one, even though they might not have been. Obadiah means servant of Yahweh. And so he's got a symbolic name as well. Alrighty. Well, now Ahab and Elijah are face to face. And this little passage here, 17 and 18, is just a wonderful back and forth. Let's have somebody read that.
And it came to pass, when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said unto him, Art thou he that troubled Israel? And he answered, I have not troubled Israel, but thou and thy father's house, in that ye have forsaken the commandment of the Lord, and thou hast followed Balaam.
That's great. Balaam is the Hebrew plural of Baal. So the more modern translations say the Baals. And, you know, you can also say Baal. Some people pronounce it in what's probably a more accurate way. It's all the same thing, referring to this type of fertility god who was supposed to be in control of the rain and the vegetation. The life story of this god, this is just a little parenthesis, Baal was understood to be alive, to come to life in the spring and to live during the summer and then to die in the fall and be dead all winter and then be resurrected in the spring again. And so it's part of Baal's biography that he would be dead part of the time. And it's one of the things that this story is going to set out and do, it suggests that Baal is never alive. But right here, this back and forth, Ahab the king sees the prophet and he says, you are the troubler of Israel. You're the problem. If you wouldn't take this vow on behalf of God, saying, you know, God has made an oath and I'm going to support it, that there's not going to be any rain, we wouldn't be in this mess. And Elijah just turns it right around and says, I'm not the troubler, you're the troubler. Troubler is a word that they used in connection with taking oaths and making vows. So somebody who took a bad oath was a troubler, or was in trouble, and somebody who broke their oath was a troubler of the covenant that they'd made. And so, holding up this mirror, Elijah to Ahab says, think about it, the covenant, the commandments, who's the one who's broken an oath here? That's not me. And so then Elijah proposes this contest. Now therefore have all Israel assemble for me at Mount Carmel with the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. He's not really saying it's Ahab's fault that these prophets are there, but obviously the prophets continue to exist with Ahab's lack of stopping them. Mount Carmel is a hill about 4,000 feet high that is right on the coast. One end of it is a promontory out into the ocean, the Mediterranean. And it's right between the territory that's controlled by the Canaanites to the north, where Tyre and Sidon are, and mostly Israel to the south. So it's a nice location to have these two sides confront each other. It's long been a holy place, I understand. There often was worship on this mountain, and so this is the place where they're going to meet. So now we are right up to the famous story that contest itself. Let's read 20 to 24, somebody please. Your best storytelling voice.
So Ahab sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you go limping with two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." And the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I only am left a prophet of the Lord. But Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose one bull for themselves, and cut it in pieces, and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. And I will prepare the other bull, and lay it on the wood, and put no fire to it. And you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord, and the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people answered, "It is well spoken."
The people make a move here. First, they're not willing to commit themselves one way or the other. They may be kind of like Ahab. They want to have both sides going there. But then Elijah makes the proposal a little sharper, and well, they're willing to go along with it. Yeah, there can be a contest, and they'll go with the winner. That sounds good. What people don't know is that consenting even that far, they've already consented to worship the God of Israel, but they haven't yet seen that that will be the outcome. But there is, in this story, the point being made that at least you have to be willing to give your consent to something. Just standing there and saying nothing and making no choice is not going to cut it. And that when you consent to go with the living God, the one who responds, who acts, who hears prayer, you know, then it's in the bag. Because from the point of view of the writer, the only God who will respond that way is the God who is, the God who lives. But it takes the people a while to get to that point. The limping thing is a really nice picture. If you're not choosing, you're limping. You can't run, you can't really get anywhere. It might be a reflection of, they think that the kind of dances that went with this fertility stuff was sort of like down on one knee and then up and then down again. And so it's sort of a limping dance. I mean, you wouldn't call it that. If you liked the dance, you'd call it a up and down beautiful dance or something like that. But the prophet looks at it and says, "Limping! Ha! Limping." And it just becomes a metaphor for not making clear choices. I understand that at Matins, maybe a week and a half ago, I think it was just before I got here, at Matins one morning, someone took a bowl and put some large stones in the bowl, 4 or 5 large stones, and then put some smaller gravel in the bowl, and then put a lot of sand in the bowl. And then she took another bowl and she put first the sand and then the gravel, and then the large stones didn't fit. They were higher than the top of the bowl. And her point was, you need to put first in your life the important things, and then the smaller things will arrange themselves around. But if you just have the small things in your life, there won't be room for the important things. And choosing to worship the God of the covenant is one of those big things that is recommended, not only recommended, but it's kind of insisted upon by this story, and letting the other things fall where they may. Well, let's hear what happens. I mean, this is just a beautifully written story. You know, you kind of hear this and you just, what good writing. It's just so well drawn. You can see it in movie terms. You know, you can almost see the crowd of thousands that are there as the 850 prophets of Baal and Asherah are dancing around their altar and making noise. And Elijah's satire. Let's hear it. That's verses 25 to 29.
Then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it first, for you are many.
and call on the name of your God, but put no fire to it. And they took the bull which was given them, and they prepared it, and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, O Baal, answer us. But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they limped about the altar which they had made. And at noon Elijah mocked them, saying, Cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing, or he has gone aside, or he is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and must be awakened. And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. But there was no voice. No one answered. No one heeded.
Three times it says, nothing happened. No voice. No answer. No one heeded. And one euphemism here, when Elijah is mocking them at noon, saying, cry louder, make sure your God can hear. Surely he is a God. Maybe he's meditating. Don't gods need to meditate sometimes? Or he's wandered away. This is like we're on a hike together and you say, excuse me, I see some bushes over there. And go off with your toilet paper. That's what Baal is being charged with right here. Or he's on a journey, he's not even home, or maybe he's asleep and must be wakened. We know the psalmist says the God of Israel never sleeps. So this is just wonderful writing. Anything else you notice here or want to comment about?
It's a futile effort.
Uh-huh. All the fuss, all the fury, and it amounts to nothing. All sound and fury, signifying nothing, the Shakespeare quote. Then, let's see what happens when Elijah takes center stage. Now this is late in the day, it's 3 o'clock, you know, something like that. And the prophets of Baal have had all this time and put all this energy into it. Now Elijah comes forward, verses 30 to 40.
Then Elijah said to all the people, come near to me. And all the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, Israel shall be your name. And with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench about the altar as great as would contain 2 measures of seed. And he put the wood in order and cut the bull in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill 4 jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. And the water ran round about the altar and filled the trench also with water. And at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that thou art God in Israel, and that I am thy servant, and that I have done all these things at thy word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that thou, O Lord, art God, and that thou hast turned their hearts back. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all of the people saw it, they fell on their faces, and they said, The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. And Elijah said to them, Seize the prophets of Baal, let not one of them escape. And they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and killed them there.
Ufta. Ufta. Let's start by noticing the contrast between the frenzy of the prophets of Baal and the stately, methodical preparations of Elijah. And Elijah really uses the opportunity to remind the people of who they are. He reaches far back, O God of Abraham, of Isaac, of Israel. He uses Jacob's name, which is Israel, which is the name of the kingdom that they live in. He doesn't he uses all God, apple pie, and mother. It's as patriotic as can be, reaching far back to the covenant with God. And just in a straightforward way, he humbly prays, and God responds. This is a very practical definition of what it means to be God. To be God means that you hear people when they pray and you respond. Baal is not God because Baal did not hear the people, or if he heard the people, he did not respond. Yahweh is God because God heard the people and responded. And the other part of being God, according to this story, is the power that God has over the forces of nature. Baal could not send lightning to consume the sacrifice, even though Baal was purportedly the rain god. And the God of Israel, who was known for being a God of relationship, also was God of nature, and is the one who came up with the lightning. And even under difficult circumstances with all that water, was it sea water? Because remember, they were in a drought. Where did they get the water? Well, Mount Carmel's right at the sea, so maybe. God, Yahweh, managed to burn all of that up. So, pretty clear outcome. And the people recognize it as such. And when the fire falls from heaven, they fall on their faces. In other words, they begin again to worship. They're no longer equivocal. They're no longer saying, you know, well, it doesn't matter. We're not really going to choose. They had gotten earlier to making the point of saying, okay, we'll go with the winner. Well, this is no longer that kind of rational stance that they're in control of. This is worship and praise. And they are restored as a nation to who they were before, people who worship Yahweh. And what that should mean is they also take concern to reestablish righteousness and compassion within their community. Pretty clear, isn't it? Some people trouble over Elijah wiping out all those prophets. Do you think that's fair? Do you think it was called for?
Was it against one of the commandments?
What?
It was against one of the commandments, right?
No, thou shalt not kill. Unless the commandments were just for the community and did not apply to those outside the community.
Probably didn't have a jail handy.
Yeah.
Or cruise missiles.
That's right. Well, this is the version of cruise missiles, actually. This is responding with cruise missiles.
Who's to say, though, that by witnessing such a astonishing act, I mean, look at the risk that Elijah put himself at. I mean, honestly, all these people and he's saying this is what's going to happen, and it happened. Who's to say that the prophets of Baal didn't all of a sudden believe?
They may have converted.
They did. If you wanted to look at them as, I mean, if they were the prophets for, if you want to call them Satan, Baal is Satan. In that sense, we need to get rid of the evil. Mm-hmm.
This is a real troubling part of the story, and it's part of a whole troubling theme in the Old Testament of when God is reported to have commanded and sanctioned violence, really punitive violence. And I don't want to minimize our wrestling with that problem. It's something that keeps people from our faith because they think that God is violent, or it causes people to dismiss the Old Testament and say, God there is mean, but God here in the New Testament is good. I want us to keep wrestling with that problem. I don't know how much time we'll take on it today. Yeah.
The politics of the time, had he decided to let all of the other prophets live, they may have made arguments that Baal was, this was the off-season for Baal, or Elijah, he was trickery or magnifying glass, or I don't know what.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't say directly that God told Elijah to kill him.
Yeah.
But Elijah may have thought that was prudent.
Yeah, and I think there are at least two things within the ethics of the story that put this in perspective. The one thing is, what had Jezebel been doing? Killing the prophets. And at least presumably this was no, this was eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. It was not overreacting, it was she killed them all, although Obadiah saved at least 100 of them. Now God's side will kill those prophets off. So it was fairly even-handed. I think the other thing about this is the story was told and written at Josiah's time, looking back. And at Josiah's time, people were not in a position to commit genocide. They were troubled, they were trying to survive and stay alive. And so for oppressed and beleaguered people to look back a couple generations and say, we got them good, is not to say, we have the power to take up arms and go get them good. Hearing that story, we say, well, God can act on our side and we can hang in here a little bit longer. Let's try to be faithful. So to me, it makes a big difference when you're in a position of power and you tell a story about killing them off. Or if you're in a position of weakness and you tell a story about killing them off. The story of the plagues in Egypt, the slaves, told the story of how the Egyptians got killed off. The people around the campfires in the wilderness who had just been freed from slavery told the stories of how the Egyptians got killed off during the plagues. They didn't pick up their swords and kill them off, but they said, ha, God did it for us. And if this story is functioning this way, God did it for us. The book of Revelation is the same way. The people, the early church who's being oppressed, tells stories of a great battle in which God clearly wipes out the enemies, throws the dragon into the fiery pit forever and ever and all that stuff. And they weren't in a position to pick up their sword and make it real, but they were in a position to hope that God would bring the victory. And I think when this story about Ahab versus Elijah and Yahweh versus Baal was told, the people weren't in a position to wipe out all the other foreign prophets, but they could be heartened by the story to make better choices.
It also made the people who had recently turned from Baal to God to act on their belief.
Yeah.
They were the ones that rounded them up, obviously, did Elijah to do it for himself.
Yeah.
And they had to act against who had led them to worship.
Yeah.
So they made a definite choice.
You bet.
You have to have been evil. And you are the evil man. We know God is good.
Yeah. Now, we need to go right away into thinking about our own culture and the things that, as people of faith, we want to say yes to and the things that we, as people of faith, want to say no to. This story invites us to fall before the God who gives the gift of rain. To fall before the God who cares for people and hears them when they cry out. And so let's share a bit about the yeses that we want to say, what we want to say yes to, who we think God represents, what we think God represents, and what we try to say no to by our lives and our choices.
In the New Testament, Jesus says, I did not come to bring peace but a sword at one time too. So it's not all peace and quiet for him in the New Testament either.
Yeah.
And here, in order to stand up for our faith, we need to sometimes bring discomfort to those around us.
Mm-hmm. Setting a boundary, saying yes or saying no to something, for one thing, means there are other things we can't say yes to or no to. So it means limiting our choices in some ways. Not everything's available anymore if we say yes to a particular way or if we say no and do something else. And it can make people very uncomfortable. It can make us uncomfortable too as we live out the consequences of those big choices. Yeah?
The question that comes to my mind during this is now when we are in dialogue with the Muslim faith and these other religions. Like Luke says, there's a difference between dialogue and mutual worship, but I have a hard time understanding the purpose, the goal of this. It's to witness to them, supposedly, but
Yeah, you're saying, is this a stance we can take anymore? Can we be so clear about how important it is to worship God as we understand God in a pluralistic world when people have other ways of worshiping the gods that they know to be God?
Maybe if we shoot them, they will come over on our side.
No, pardon, I didn't hear that. Easier to shoot them?
He was accusing me of saying it'd be easier for us to shoot people that don't agree with it. No, no, but I just, I don't, I wonder if we're saying to our own people that it's all right to marry, it's all right to take into our own lives the good parts of their worship, the doing good. And there's enough of that already in our Lutheran church. We think if we're doing good, we're going to be saved, and that's what's going to do it. Mm-hmm. Like every other religion preaches, and it's only Christianity that says grace alone, faith alone. I think there's a danger to our Christian church.
So you think the word of Elijah is helpful because it reminds us to remember our roots, our origins, our identity, and to make good choices. Yeah, but I mean that tension is really there. Yeah, but if we do that, who are we saying? You know, we're not just saying no to certain practices. We may be understood as saying no to certain people. Yeah.
But I think it takes away a lot of the fence riders. I mean, by this story, I mean, it feels like this story is telling us that you believe. If you don't believe, this really makes it concrete that this is the way it is, and it takes away that. I mean, because there are other places where people would say, okay, well, yeah, there's the fire, but where did it really come from? I mean, a lot of scientific stuff can be weeded out from that, because the word is the word.
Are we being Ahabs?
In
our relationship to other religions that are claiming salvation by works?
Mm-hmm. Good question. So we can consider this both at an individual level, which is the level recommended in the chapter, saying yes and saying no in this book, Practicing Our Faith, gives a spiritual exercise called the examination of conscience, which asks some questions which helps you look at your own practice and discover what you're saying yes to by where you spend your time, your money, your energy, your effort, and what you're saying no to, and encouraging you to choose more of God's life and to say no to more of the things that oppose God. We can do that as individuals, and we also try to discern corporately as a community of faith how to say yes to life and how to say no to death, and exactly what that means when it comes down to a concrete situation. Tonight at the forum, we have a chance to talk about our response to terrorism and how is it possible to say yes and no clearly and effectively in a confusing and difficult situation like that. Let's go to Psalm 82. Oh, the end of the chapter just has the rain coming, and Ahab breaks the fast and starts feasting at Elijah's command, while Elijah pulls out on the top of the mountain waiting to see that storm cloud rise. And when the storm cloud rises, then Elijah happily tells Ahab he better get in his chariot right away or it's going to get stuck in the mud. And Ahab heads off towards his secondary palace in Jezreel, 17 miles away. But lo and behold, Elijah gets there first because the spirit, the breath, the wind of the Lord helps him run. And I'm sure that at the gates, Elijah is proclaiming in Jezreel that Yahweh is God and is to be worshipped. Psalm 82 is a psalm that sort of describes what's just happened in this chapter. It's been called the Miss America contest of the gods. all the gods are understood as being in the heavenly council. You know, every god has a voice and a vote. There's Baal, there's Asherah, there's somebody else, there's somebody else, and there's Yahweh. Only, Yahweh is not just a god among gods. It turns out that Yahweh is the judge of the other gods, according to this psalm. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. And so now God is looking at the other gods and is going to say on what basis Yahweh judges the other gods to be deficient and at fault. Yahweh says to all of the other gods, "How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Give justice to the weak and the orphan. Maintain the right of the lowly and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked." No other god but Yahweh shows that kind of compassion, and that's why God is going to proceed with the judgment as follows. First, there's this editorial comment about the other gods. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk around in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken when they have their way. The earth is in danger of collapse. Society is in danger of collapse. So God says, "I say, you are gods, children of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, you shall die like mortals and fall like any prince." So God the judge has not only said, "You gods are all deficient," God has said, "You will all be executed." You may have been something, but from now on you're nothing. And so the people in the psalm pleading, "Rise up, O God, judge the earth, for all the nations belong to you." Chapter 18 of Kings is that psalm in a dramatic form. And the bell has rung. You're free to go to coffee, but if you'd like to sing the hymn of the day, it's in the green book. It's number 415, God of Grace and God of Glory. All four of them. I hate cutting things short. Hope to see you tomorrow for the next chapter.